Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tennis Channel Insight In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Mitch Michaels from the Santa Monica Studios, ready to bring you another great episode talking tennis with a couple of A-list guests. It's Jan Michael Gamble to recap the Laver Cup, Roger Federer's emotional retirement, and the first win in the series by Team World. Team World gets it done behind Felix, Auger-Aliassime, and Francis Tiafoe. We break down Dominic Thiem's comeback, Medvedev struggles, storylines in the women's game, a Davis Cup controversy, a lot of talk with Jan Michael Gamble, and then Jordan Sanford, former Tennis Channel colleague. She was a writer for the tennis.com website and the Baseline series. She's doing a ton of tremendous stuff, working with the USTA, working for Variety, writing pieces and working on their content team, and the technical director for All American Homecoming on the CW network. Talk to Jordan Sanford a little bit about her tennis journey from Baylor Hall of Fame to the tennis media. Big fun chat with her. You're not going to want to miss that. It's Jan Michael Gamble and Jordan Sanford on this week's Tennis Channel Insight. And here we go. All right, now on Tennis Channel Insight In, we're almost into October. Jan Michael Gamble here to break down really the final push of the tennis season. I know that there's some fatigue in the air. Not in this room, though. We're ready to just keep pushing forward.
Absolutely none here. None whatsoever. We've been calling a lot of tennis, and there's been a lot of great tennis still to be played at the in the fall. There's opportunities for players to make some moves. You're right. There's going to be some players who will be fatigued mentally. Some injuries can happen at the end of the year. When do you take the time off? Some players will elect to take some time off, but it's still some big tournaments yet to be played.
Yeah, and I think we can kind of actually start here. It's fascinating to me. I know there's an argument, and I know there's validity to the fact that the season can be long. Some players are just burned out and they've been putting so much into it. But there are a lot of players that love this time of year and that need this time of year. I mean, you just finished calling the Dominic Thiem Marin Cilic match, and that was an example of somebody in Thiem. And I guess in Cilic too a little bit, but they still want to find their form. There's a lot of tennis left in their careers, and they want to use this time to really not just set themselves up for 2023, but really find, you know, what their best level is already.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Cilic is playing some very high-level tennis, played well at the U.S. Open, lost, of course, to the eventual winner, and Carlos Alcaraz, not a bad loss there for him, and that took five sets for Carlito to get through that one. So, you know, Cilic is high-level, back in the top 20. Could he be back in the top 10? I think it's a possibility for him. His level is there. For Dominic Thiem, a player that I certainly love watching, and you know, it's been tough with him being sidelined. I had injuries myself that sidelined my career permanently at the end. You know, I don't wish that on anybody else. And to see Thiem back out there playing at what I think is very close to his level that we've seen from Thiem in the past. The forehands is just a little bit off right now. He's missing too many forehands in some of these matches against some tougher players who can sustain the rallies. Cilic is one of them.
Yeah.
The rest of the game looks great from Thiem. So for him, does he need more matches? Sure, he's going to play as much as he possibly can and stay as long as he can keep those injuries at bay.
Yeah, he's always been a really fit guy. You've never really questioned that. What do you think about the scheduling, how he's kind of done it? He's slowly ramping up. It seems like he's looking out for himself, but he's also playing the right events, did the Challenger, is playing as much tennis as he can without kind of overdoing it.
Yeah, he made that Challenger final, lost to Umbera in the final there, so that was that I don't think was a particularly good match, but that was a lot of matches played. So that's that's what he's looking for, is get out on the court, play matches against these tough competitors, play a good match, I thought, against Cilic. There was smiles on the face of Thiem after that match was over. I think he was happy with his performance, obviously didn't want to lose the match, but Cilic came up with the goods. So, you know, keep playing the matches, check in on the body. If it feels good, I think he plays as many events as he possibly can, try to boost the ranking a little bit. Thiem's in a place that's a little bit different from other players who might have injuries, to the fact that he's going to get some wild cards if he wants them. I don't know how many protective ranking he has left. It's probably a couple, so he can use that. So he'll be in events. He'll have opportunities to play main draws. You pick and choose those the right way, and pretty happy with the way he's playing.
Yeah, up to, I think, around the 160 mark in the live ranking. So he's progressing, he's climbing, maybe not as fast as he would have wanted to, but getting there. And if he has to play some qualifying, you know, maybe that's a good form to get more match play as well.
I absolutely agree. Playing some extra matches, playing some qualifying. We saw Wawrinka do it recently. He qualified and started winning some matches. I think that Stan is playing some high-level tennis too.
That's a good one. Stan at 37 beat Medvedev is starting to kind of, I mean, I don't want to say final push with certainty, but this appears to be the final push.
Well, you never know. You never know how long you can play. Yeah. Roger just retired at 41, so that gives Stan, if you're going to judge it by that, a few more good years. And, you know, he's had the problems with his knee and his foot, or I think ankle, so that, you know, those hopefully are in the past. I like the way that I saw Stan playing. And he went and played the qualies and had to do it and came up with some good wins. So, you know, you just need the matches. You need the confidence.
You certainly do. As we look in the rearview mirror at the weekend, Laver Cup had, you know, the center of the tennis world. Everybody was looking forward to it. On the one hand, which we'll get to in a second, Team World wins their first Laver Cup. But it was really about just saying goodbye to Roger Federer, and it was as tremendous of a goodbye that you could offer. I mean, nothing would have ever been enough for a guy like Roger Federer, but the last match, he plays with Rafa. They lose a tight one to Sock and TFO, and they get the tribute there. It was an emotional night. But just, I guess, starting with this, Jan Michael, the visual of him playing in his last match, what you saw from him on the court, the level looked pretty good. Ultimately, just getting that one last chance for all of us to see him play. What was that like?
Well, that was neat. And he went out there with the guy that he's competed so many times against, with Rafa. That's what he wanted to do. Roger did it on his own terms and in a fantastic event that they've created. The Laver Cup is an exciting event. It was nice to see Team World finally win one.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It was certainly overshadowed by Roger deciding to retire. It seemed a little abrupt. It almost seemed like, and Roger's such a class act, it almost seemed like he gave Serena some space.
Yeah.
His retirement. He didn't do it, you know, close to her, gave that a little bit of room to breathe. We lose Serena, now we lose Roger. This was Roger's moment. As far as retirements go, I still think Pete and Ash Barty maybe did it the best, win a slam and then say, hey, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. But This was emotional for a lot of people, emotional certainly for everybody involved there and for all the fans of Roger, which there are so many, myself included. It was wonderful.
I think that's a great point. I think he didn't want to overshadow Serena. He also didn't want to overshadow the U.S. Open by making an announcement while the tournament was going on. I was impressed with how, you know, it was great to just see that the level was still good. I know it was a doubles match, and he said he's not at the level where he needed to be to contend for majors. But I guess selfishly, we were just glad that he could play out there and play at a high level and show off the hands and play with Rafa. And, you know, it wasn't about the outcome of the match, although he's a very competitive guy. What I love the most about this weekend, among other things, Jan Michael, is the fact that, you know, he stayed involved after the match was over Friday night. He's just a consummate professional. And in that ceremony, he wanted the team to be included as much as possible. So I think he's leaving a void that I don't think everyone will be directly replaced, but I just keep going back to leaving the game in good hands and how there's so many young, exciting, fun players coming up that were directly inspired by him. I think that might be his lasting legacy, along with all the championships and everything that he's done.
Yeah, I think exactly. I think you can take it just from our brand new world number one, and Carlos Alcaraz, who will often say that a lot of his game is patterned after Roger Federer as a Spaniard.
Yeah.
And you know, when you have a Rafa Nadal, so, you know, he competes like Rafa, but hits his forehand more like Roger does. And there's some inspiration there. So, you know, Roger transcends our sport. He is a fantastic athlete. He's a showman. He's a champion for so many good things off the court, an ambassador like we've never really seen in our sport. And I think somebody who's going to stick around and remain very much a part of tennis. So we certainly won't have seen our last of Roger. Yeah. But he did it his way, and it was just a great, great send-off.
The speech was great. Obviously, the emotional stuff when he recognized his family. I love the part where he said, you know, it wasn't supposed to be this way. Like, I started playing tennis just because I had fun. So I think there might be a lesson in there somewhere that you don't have to. You can ramp up to focusing. It started with a place of joy. Like, he just loved the game, and it blossomed from there. So,
well, I think you can see that in the end. And he chose a team event to do it along his guys that he competed with so well on his own team. It's just kind of amazing that you could finally finish it that way.
It was. And I mean, Rafa was so emotional. I think part of it is, you know, part of it is obviously the friendship they developed competing with him. And I think another side might be just seeing, you know, the end is in sight for all these guys. They're not anytime soon, hopefully, but I think everybody, especially the big four there, kind of knows their own mortality when they see a guy like Roger, who we just, you know, associated with the game for so long. And if he retires, I mean, unfortunately, it will not be much longer for everybody to play that's at that, you know, level and age.
Well, certainly. I mean, you think about all the times that they've competed against each other, so much time on court, so many events that they've done together, you know, for the good of the sport. And Rafa certainly has plenty more in him. He's played some excellent tennis this year, a couple of slams, and really only lost that one Grand Slam match. He had to default at Wimbledon. So Rafa, plenty of tennis ahead of him, but I think it was just a very emotional weekend for everyone, and they did it the right way.
Great gesture by Rafa to be at the event, given, you know, that his wife's pregnant, the injury issues. We know it was great to see Novak Djokovic and Roger, who haven't had the best of friends relationship, that they were able to, you know, come together. Murray obviously belonged. And I think for the young guys too, on both Team World and Team Europe, to see this and be a part of this moment is going to be good for them as well.
Absolutely. And I love, you know, had that emotional moment, which we've seen replayed so many times on media, and, you know, see, you know, Roger sort of breaking down, and then Rafa, and then, you know, Andy sees that and takes a step back, so much respect that he has for everyone. And I really respect what he did in that moment. Because he understood that, you know, what was taking place between the two of them. Those pictures are really strong.
They really are. And you mentioned his post career that's going to involve tennis. I know the world is his oyster. Like, he can literally do whatever he wants. But what would you like to see him do? If there's, I guess, one that stands alone, what do you think a good tennis involved role for Roger is post playing career?
Well, I think that Roger's going to be heavily involved in charity, and that's those. I think he's involved in several charities. I think that for Roger to continue to get people involved in our great sport, and he does a lot of traveling around, getting, you know, kids that maybe not have opportunities to play tennis, that exact thing, opportunities to get a racket in their hand, a tennis ball, and obviously he can still play exhibitions, bring our sport to places that may not see it. These great champions, the big three, the big four, add in some of the current young crop of amazing players and great personalities, and you have, you know, fodder for some wonderful exchanges and opportunities to really show the world how great tennis is.
Yeah, I can't think of a better ambassador for any sport. Like, just off the top of my head, for being a sportsman, there's nobody better. So again, props to Roger Federer. It was an unbelievable career. We were all lucky to have seen it be on this earth at the time that he was playing tennis. The odds weren't in our favor there. Team World gets their first Laver Cup, though, and they did it. You know, they did it on the backs of Francis Tiafoe and Felix Auger-Aliassime. I mean, it was, you know, the Sunday performances by those guys. Felix beating Novak Djokovic in singles, and then to kind of follow that up with the Francis win, it was a big moment. It was one that I think you'd like to see, Jan Michael, that it propels them in the big matches against these top guys in Grand Slam tournaments.
Absolutely. Well, he's going to give these guys, these young guys, you know, it starts with Francis making the semifinals at the U.S. Open. And that's going to
travel down. He's very
absolutely
confident.
He's confident, and that's going to trickle down for the other Americans, say, well, hey, I've, you know, had good wins myself. I think I can compete at that same level. And I think we're going to see the young Americans being inspired by what Tiafoe's doing, what Big Fo and his great tennis, great attitude that he's had is now really shining through. Everybody loves the guy. And so a lot of people behind him. This is another great event for him, the Laver Cup. And for Felix Auger-Aliassime, who can be sometimes a little inconsistent in his matches, he certainly wasn't there. He rises to the occasion, these big matches against guys that are supposed to, on paper, beat him and comes up with the goods. Laver Cup is special because you have that opportunity to come back on the last day.
Mm-hmm. I feel like both of these players, their limitations, if you even want to call it that, are kind of different. I feel like for Francis, it's been just playing a full match. There's been little dips before, you know, the U.S. Open run where, you know, he's been right with these guys and just had like a 5-10 minute wall stretch where it just hasn't happened. For Felix, I get the sense that sometimes, if it's possible, he's a little too bottled up. Like, him showing some emotion and some fire out there can actually be a great thing, and I think he started to do that. And, you know, I hope it snowballs. Like we said, it can go negative one way for players that struggle, but for wins and you know, you get on a roll, I think this could be good too, because Felix has always been there, and I think he's got the game that could win majors and win a couple of them.
Yeah, I think he does have that game. Gets inconsistent at times, especially in the forehand. Sometimes it leaves him, and you know, he gets a little stiff. And so that's actually maybe some great insight there, Mitch, on him showing some emotion. That team format worked for him. He was excited out there. He takes it so seriously and so professionally. Maybe just letting a little bit of that out of the bottle could be a good thing. And for Francis, for me, it's always been that forehand. People know the forehand breaks down under sustained pressure. He clips at the tape and gets it a little bit of a flat delivery. I think he's done some very good work on it. And as well, he's also serving better than I've ever seen him serve. At the U.S. Open, he served huge to get himself in those positions. And that's continued forward.
Yeah, there's no shame in that match against Alcaraz. Like, that was unbelievable fight. His level was there. I mean, there's been dips at other times, but that was just the guy. He ran into a buzzsaw, a guy that never gets tired.
I mean, he was dead even with the new number one in the world.
Yeah.
And could have just as easily won that match and very well could the next time they play.
I think there's a message in there for both of these players as well that have pretty stable camps. They've worked with the same coaches, the same routine, and I think that's good.
How about that?
Yeah. Not to name names, but you kind of know players that are on both tours that are kind of running through coaches and changing things up too much. That might not be a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, Francis in Wayne Fiera has a fantastic coach, believes in him, chose the right guy, and they've done a lot of good, hard work. And Wayne's got him focused, and it's the right person in place for him. And you know, sometimes it's a little bit tricky. Some players may not gel that well with a coach and might need to make some adjustments, but you got to stick with the coach for a while. You can't do it every other month trying to change it up like that. It doesn't work.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
More with Jan-Michael Gamble here on Tennis Channel Inside In. Well, again, congrats to Team World. They win the Laver Cup. And we mentioned Tiafoe and Fritz, some of these Americans. In San Diego, Brandon Nakashima won his first title, a 250 in his home state, which I want to start out by saying, you know, props to him. This is a kid that's been coming up. And, you know, to pick your spot to where you win your first title, it doesn't get much better than doing it where you grew up.
Absolutely. Nakashima, you know, he's continued to put the good results together. He's been in a couple finals before that. It's nice to see two Americans in that final. I think that Marcos is playing some fantastic tennis as well. Mm-hmm. He's raised his level, continued to raise his level over the years. Very hard worker. Nakashima, we're going to see him doing a lot of good work on tour. He's got a very complete game. Seems confident. Mm-hmm. In fact, I even saw him smile after he won the title. Yeah. You don't get a lot of emotion out of Nakashima, but he was excited about it. And that was, I think, also a good thing for people and his fans to see.
I don't think there was anything that frustrated Kyrgios more at Wimbledon than that match against Nakashima, not getting anything out of him.
You're never going to get anything out of him, whether he's ahead or behind in a match. It's it's sort of an advantage for Brandon. That's just his personality works out that way.
So I think by my count, it's 8 Americans now in the top 50 with Marcos at 53. Mm-hmm. So this is, like, and Opelka put it perfectly a while back, like, the world beaters might not be there, but the depth hasn't been stronger in a long time. And I do think that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, and these guys are going to be pushing each other. It's good to see Tommy Paul step up, Francis, Nakashima, Garone. I mean, with the old guard Isner still working forward, I mean, there is a lot of depth to the American men's game now.
There is, and, you know, how about Cressy, the guy that he's out there to beat anybody. He has this idea that he can take his serve and volley game and take it through and win these events, beat pretty much anybody in the world. That's what he thinks. Had a good win against Sebi Korda today, pretty straightforward win there. Mm. So you really have this new crop that believe they can win, aren't afraid of playing the top players.
Yeah.
And again, I go back to Tiafoe making it to a semifinal in a Grand Slam. That is a huge result. That is going to give these other guys some really good confidence as well.
Korda and Brooksby, two other guys coming up. I love that everybody has different styles too. It's not just like a factory of everybody plays the same way. Cressy, Brooksby, you know. I think the two that I just mentioned, Korda and Brooksby, I think they're going to need some time on tour. I think it's like Francis. It took him years of being a pro and dealing with different pro game styles and losing and having to kind of build up. Because I really do like what both of those guys offer, but I think they need, you know, they need a couple years of being a pro. They're still relatively young, so I think it'll happen for them, but just in a few.
I think both those guys still obviously developing too. Young guys still developing, you know, physically. They both have a lot of good weapons. They've both been out there long enough now that some of the players have figured out their games and so are coming up with some solutions to how to beat them in some of these matches. Well, that goes means you go back to the drawing board, start to work on some things yourself, work hard in the off season, you know, and hope to start out next year well. But I agree that they both have very, very high levels that I think they can achieve.
It's a fun time to be an American tennis fan on the men's side, especially we mentioned the ATP rankings and some stuff shifting. One of the players I just want to get your thoughts on, Stan notched that big win over Medvedev, but another loss for Medvedev, another, you know, disappointing outcome in a tournament, obviously not nearly the level of the U.S. Open where he lost to Kyrgios, but do you think that there's any areas of concern for Medvedev? I know he hasn't been able to play the full way through, but he's had some losses. He's lost the number one ranking, and for a guy that built up his resume and his reputation on consistency, it just hasn't been there. Are you concerned at all with his game?
Well, he had such a good year last year and played so well. Was the best player certainly on the hard courts in the world by far. And you know now, you know it's hard to repeat those years. I'm not really that concerned. I think that Medvedev's got a great game. He competes so hard in his matches. Got the big serve, good ground strokes, defends well, does all those things. He's got a pretty good head on his shoulders. Maybe he just needs to take a little time off at the end of the year. Have a good off season. And come back stronger. I believe he's still going to win more slams. He's a threat pretty much every time on the court. Even played better on the clay this year. So there are actually some positives you can take away from the year. He held that number one ranking for quite some time. So you have to think that that's impressive stuff. There are some people trying to track him down. There's some people coming for him. Mm-hmm. Carlos is one of them.
Makes you really appreciate the big three, big four even more to just keep stacking those years. And if he has a Kyrgios problem, so does a lot of people. So do a lot of people on Kyrgios tour. He's tough to beat.
You know, the guy's focused now. He's out there to actually win these matches and seems to care, which is a little bit of a bluff. I think he's always cared. I've always really admired him off court. He's such a wonderful person. On the court has had some demons, but he seems to have those demons mostly in check. Yeah. One of my favorite players to watch, and I think he's great for our game. So it's nice to see Kyrgios playing so high level as well.
It really is. Medvedev was in the Mosei tournament when he lost to Stan. It was won by Sonego, who beat Bublik in the final. Quick note on Sonego, that's now a tournament on every surface. So he completed that hat trick. But the point that people were watching was Bublik kind of turning it into an exhibition by going racket upside down. And I don't dislike Bublik. It's fun. It's exciting. I'll just put it this way. I don't think even Kyrgios would have done that at his lowest not caring moment, whatever that is. I just think you have to have a level of professionalism in a tournament final.
Yeah, I have a hard time. I have some hard time with Bublik on the court sometimes, but he is so talented.
Yeah.
I thought he played well in Davis Cup. He's got a gigantic serve, likes indoor tennis. I think it suits him quite well, the indoor courts. Yeah. He's got the big ground strokes when he's on. He can play so well. He has these kind of sets where he's completely off, though, and he sort of just loses his mind a little bit and does. He makes it into a little bit of an exhibition. Let's be honest. He cares about having fun on the court, and that's Bublik having fun on the court. Has some antics, tries some tricks.
What you're saying about the bluff thing, though, with Kyrgios. Like, I don't think these guys don't care. I think they kind of hide behind it when things aren't going bad. It's like, well, then I just don't care.
You know? It's like after the match is over. Okay, what happens there? For me, I wore my heart on my sleeve in my matches, and after I would lose a match, and I ever tried something crazy like that, but turning my racket around, hit with the grip, but I would go stare at the wall the rest of the day.
Yeah.
That's how much it mattered to me. Now, if they can kind of shrug it off a little bit, it's a little bit of a bluff, but for Bublik, again, he's just trying to have a good time playing the sport that I think he likes. He seems to like it from more some days than others. People are going to frown upon things when he does it like that. Some people are going to think it's funny. It makes people talk about our sport.
Yeah, I guess even more than this one, I was not a fan of at the Hall of Fame tournament in Newport when Cressy beat him and the postgame comments were like, you're like lucky.
Yeah, I didn't like that either.
You know, and that's, especially because Cressy's winning his first tournament.
Like, I mean, I'll be honest, that bothered me way more than turning the racket around and hitting with the grip. That's silly, and it's kind of funny, and it's going to get some replays on media. It wasn't a good plan for him if he wanted to try to win that set. Obviously, the comments that he made about Cressy were ridiculous because it's hard to play in those on grass courts anyway.
Yeah.
You're going to get the bad bounces. You're going to get the weird things that happen on grass. That's just part of it. too bad. Happy for Chrissy winning that tournament.
Yeah, it was big for him. Some of the women's news and notes I just want to mention before we wrap up here. In the Japan Open, we didn't see much of Naomi Osaka. Unfortunately, she had the illness and wasn't there. But the final was Samsonova over Kunwen Zhang. And those are two players that I think we're going to be seeing a lot of in the future. I mean, Samsonova's month of August was just insane. And for Q, as I call her, I think that's top five potential. I think I said top 10, but I'm raising the bar, I think.
Wow.
These are two, two players that I think are going to carry the torch here going forward.
Yeah, two big hitters as well. I mean, Samsonova, every single ball that comes off that racket is just giant. She's got a good serve. She returns big. Really enjoy watching her play tennis. One of the biggest hitters in the sport. So I agree with you. I think that she's going to have a huge future. Could certainly win a slam. I thought she was a threat at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, and Iowa beat her, and that was one of the more remarkable things, falling off Serena and then beating.
Very impressive. The defense that Tomjanovic was able to play there to get through that match was
The first set tiebreaker was like an insanely high score. I think what Samsonova does and that separates her is the second serve is very good. And if you have a good second serve in women's tennis, I think that gives you a huge advantage. She is a big hitter, and I think that that's – I think that the rankings, and this could be the post-Serena environment that we're in, but I think there's going to be a lot of movement. I think there's going to be a lot of players that, shoot up and then maybe fall back as they have to defend a lot of their points.
Yeah, I think, Świątek seems like she's got herself in a very good position there.
Just so mentally solid. She's locked in.
Now has found a way to play well on the hard courts as well. And so I think that she's going to have a lock for a little while, at least on that top ranking. But besides that, there's going to be some movers and shakers. Love seeing how well Coco Gauff has been playing. Love seeing how well Jess Pegula has been playing. A couple of Americans moving into the top 10. That is just fantastic to see as well. Coco Gauff kind of knocking at the door, made the French final. When's she going to win a slam? I think it's going to be pretty soon as well.
Pegula kept losing. It was another tournament she lost to the eventual champ. Like, it just keeps happening that way with how the draw has been shaking out. It's going to be fascinating to see. And then San Diego coming up for the women. It's 16 out of the 20, top 20.
Yeah, I saw that lineup. 500 event. Like, okay. This is going to be fun. I think the fans are going to really enjoy that week.
A few more things with Jan Michael Gamble before we wrap up here on Tennis Channel Insight. And I did want your quick thoughts. I know it's kind of like a not recent controversy, but the Canada Davis Cup thing, it just is your perspective, having played for the U.S. and knowing how important this tournament is, although it is a different format. But Canada gets to the final. They were given a wild card. They were able to come through and win their group that included Spain, but they will be into the Davis Cup final. And I know a lot of players, a lot of coaches, American captain Marty Fish, were not a fan of the fact that they had already been eliminated and they got the wild card because Russia and Belarus were kicked out. It's a difficult situation, but how do you land on it?
I think it's tough. First of all, I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around the new format of Davis Cup, the way that it's being played, the two out of three. Mm-hmm. I called a lot of those matches for T2 just a couple weeks ago, and so saw a lot of it and started to actually really enjoy the fact that you can see so many good players on a given day. Starting to come around to this new format, I still have a hard time calling it Davis Cup because Davis Cup has been 3 out of 5. It's been country versus country, traveling to these tough places
ties.
To play.
Like
the home ties versus the away ties.
Yeah.
I remember playing some Davis Cup ties where it was just so hostile of an environment you have a hard time recreating that. And I'm not seeing that now.
Yeah.
I did like the fact that, and I hope it's going to be a rotating thing where these countries that are hosting, they do have a little bit of an advantage. More fans are showing up for the home team, the host teams.
Right.
I liked this whole round robin format. So I will say that's a positive.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like that it's 2 out of 3. I'm still sort of on the fence. So on the fence there. So I haven't answered your question yet. Now, with the Canada situation, I can't quite understand how they even chose that. Like,
I don't know why they got the wild card. Like, that's the part that it was them. And I mean, maybe because they have. I mean, I'm just saying they have a top guy.
Yeah, they have
Felix.
Great players.
Like that is that
great players. I mean, on paper, it's a good idea. Chapo didn't even play. Pospisil played well, I thought. I mean, I liked a lot of the matches that they played. I have a hard time with them now in the knockout stage. We called that it was the World Group Finals, and now we actually have the Davis Cup Finals. It's kind of a lot for you to kind of assimilate,
right?
When you think about it. But do they belong to be there? Well, since they were given the opportunity, they belong to be there, yes, but they already lost, so probably not.
Yeah, and it's not a lucky loser situation in the sense that those are players in tournaments that lose in qualifying and then get the main draw option. They were already knocked out of essentially the main draw. So
right, you never see that. Just doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. The furthest you can really get is if somehow you take over the bye situation of a tournament, where there's a bye and the draw, and you can sort of get kind of far
and to be clear,
loser. But this is not that situation.
Yeah, if it was the old format and something like this happened again,
it would just be a walkover. Normally.
Yeah, it'd be a walkover.
Yeah, so. It would just been simply be a walkover. So they should have done. They probably should have just put a walkover in there.
Yeah, and this is tennis federations that are upset because this means a lot to each country's.
It does mean a lot. It does mean a lot. And in the end, you probably look at it from the sponsors, from these venues that are trying to sell seats, and they're saying, hey, we want players on court. We don't want to have no match on that day, so we're going to lose revenue there. So there's a lot of different kind of hands, in the bucket and a lot of different thought process. So of course, Marty Fish is not going to be happy with that. Of course, he will be happy with the Americans making it through. So, congrats to them. So we have a chance to do that. I think that's going to be the focus for, going forward, and you can't really worry about Canada now. The worry is can USA go get the job done, and I think we got a good shot.
Very much so with that depth we mentioned. It's going to be exciting to see. A lot of tennis still to play this year. Tennis, and we're doing pickleball now. I saw the story.
We are doing pickleball. I'm calling some pickleball next month.
And I saw the story that now we're getting teams and cities like LeBron James is an investor. We're going to keep it going.
James Blake already is a team owner.
Yeah, I think, that sport's growing leaps and bounds, especially here on the West Coast. It's just, it's getting hard to play or find a place to play.
Yeah, pickleball is always, for me, I grew up in Washington State, so I played pickleball my whole life.
I'll see that.
And for me to see it take off like this, it's kind of exciting. It's a bit strange watching how the game now is played. The singles is a little bit more like I'm sort of used to. And when I say grew up with it, we had a pickleball court in our backyard. When I was about, 11 years old, we put in our backyard. Didn't have the room for a tennis court. Made room for a pickleball court. So that was like our neighborhood thing. All my friends were athletes. None of us played. I didn't want to play tennis with them, so we played pickleball. We had neighborhood rankings, and it was just a lot of fun. We had pickleball parties. So it's easy for me to see why people sort of gravitate towards it, because it's just so much fun to play with just anybody. You can pick up a racket and have a good time and bring some food and some drinks and just enjoy yourself, where tennis is, let's be honest, it's pretty serious.
Yeah, I think there was some appeal. There is still appeal to tennis, to the casual player out there, person out there.
Pickleball does that as well. It's a little bit harder to pick up tennis, and to be good at it. It just takes a little bit more work.
Yeah.
Now, I think that the two sports can go hand in hand. I think that if you start with the pickleball, I think you can gravitate towards the tennis, and I think that the tennis players can easily pick up a pickleball racket and play, competitively. And for me, it's not one against the other. I think it's totally hand in hand. Now, some people don't like the sound of the pickleball racket, ball coming off the racket. But it's a bit loud, but it's a lot of fun to play, and it's going to be really interesting calling some of those tournaments. Looking forward to it.
Those tournaments and events look like a pretty good atmosphere, too, like a pretty good time. This has been a blast, Jan Michael Gamble. Very last thing, we try to end with like a funny note, an interesting note. Want to know if this ever happened to you, Sloan Stephens. 4-all in her third set in her match against Fretch in the first round, stung by a bee, fought through it and won the match, but said she was legit stung while playing. Did that ever happen to you, and were you able to battle through it?
I think I have been stung by a bee before. I think the weirdest thing that ever happened before was these bugs descending on the court. They see the tournament in Parma. There's like a ton of bugs in the night matches that are there. And they're all in the air. And so there's like these weird things to deal with. I was playing a tournament, I think in Ecuador, when I was trying to come back after being injured, and these huge bugs descended on the court to the point where there were so many that we had to stop the match, and they had to sweep these bugs, these beetles, whatever they were, maybe I don't know what they were, but off the court. We had to take our time and let them clean the court of these creatures before we were able to commence the rest of the match.
Did you have to request that we got to stop, or was everybody just like, no,
play.
We have to?
Yeah. You couldn't play. The balls were hitting these huge things. And it was a whole issue. But you never know what you're going to get out there.
Tennis players are tougher than they look. You got to battle the elements. Jan Michael Gamble, thanks for coming on Tennis Channel Inside In.
Thanks, Mitch.
Always a blast talking to Jan Michael Gamble, JMG, on the Tennis Channel Inside In podcast. Make sure you're safe out there from those insects and bugs. But in all seriousness, it's always a pleasure talking tennis with him, and we'll have to have him back sometime soon. Now we're going to switch it up, talk to Jordan Sanford. She was a Tennis.com writer and editor for the Baseline series, had a Hall of Fame college career at Baylor, transitioned into media, is doing some fun stuff now for Variety, working with the USTA, going on a bunch of different shoots, and working as a technical director for the CW Network for the All-American Homecoming series. She's the tennis expert there for how they film and shoot scenes. So a lot to talk about with my friend Jordan Sanford, and it's an all-encompassing chat that'll give you some advice for how you would want to break into the media industry. A lot of good stuff for former athletes out there. It's Jordan Sanford now on Tennis Channel Inside In. All right, now joining us on Tennis Channel Inside In, a real pleasure, is the former Tennis Channel colleague of mine. Some somber tone in that word, former. She was an editor at Tennis Channel's Baseline site, wrote articles, interviewed. She blended action on the court with style and fashion. Had a Hall of Fame career at Baylor, playing on the women's tennis team. That's a literal term. She is in the Hall of Fame. Now we're doing a couple different projects I want to get into, but Jordan Sanford, thank you for joining Tennis Channel Inside In.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy I finally could be on here talking with you. I'm super excited. Thank you.
It took, unfortunately, it took you no longer working here, which is more my fault than yours. But no, Jordan, this is
great. Hey, better late than never, right?
Absolutely. Better late than never. But I wanted to kind of get into your story and just how you got to all the cool stuff that you're working on. California girl, by the way. So Diamond Bar, that's where your journey started. And
yes.
Was it always an infatuation with tennis? I mean, we're going to get to the journalism and the career stuff, but were you just a fan? Were you hooked immediately when you first picked up a racket?
So I will tell you, my dad was watching the US Open, and I believe it was in 97. And he was watching the finals that year, and I think it was Venus who was playing in it that year. But anyway, I come into the room and immediately just captivated by everything that's going on the screen. And I sit next to him. I'm 5 years old too. So I sit next to him. I watch the entire final. And when it ends, I get up and I'm just like, I can do this. I want to do it. I want to play tennis. Let's go. And my dad's like, okay. And meanwhile, my dad doesn't know anything about tennis, never picked up a racket or anything. So he essentially just grabbed some books, taught himself, took me out there, and here we are today.
So you had no history of tennis in your family before?
No history at all. No.
Wow. It's a common story, but also one that I think starts out in that way, but few progress to the level you got. Was there a point, I guess, in your childhood where you thought, okay, I have to be committed to this? Or like, I guess a better way to ask that would be, when did it ramp up to where this is a commitment, and if I'm going to chase this, I have to take this seriously?
Yeah. I feel like I don't remember the exact moment, but when I picked up a racket at 5 years old, it was almost serious from the beginning. Okay. So even though, you know, I'm this tiny little thing out there, I was taking it so seriously from the start. But I would say probably when I was 8 years old, when I got my first coach outside of my dad, that's when we were like, okay, the mission, the goal is to play pro tennis.
When did college become a factor? When did you think, okay, this is what I want to do? I know you did a stint at Maryland before you ended up at Baylor. How did college kind of become the focal point? What did you do to get to that point where you could achieve that dream of playing in college?
Yeah, I think it was a really hard decision for me to make, to either playing pro tennis, going the college route. And so I was playing some professional tournaments leading up to that. And I had essentially every school that I wanted kind of reaching out to me, and I would start going on official visits. And that's when I kind of knew, I was like, I also want to have my education too. And, you know, maybe try pro tennis afterwards. But that's kind of when it became more so of a reality, and I accepted that, you know, the college route was the way to go for me.
Well, you were kind of ahead of the curve in a lot of ways, and it was you know, your age demographic is when the college tennis boom, I think, really has taken off. And now you see so many college players that have made the pro game. What was, was the level of college being kind of as high as it was? Did that surprise you? Were you shocked that there were as many good players playing in college? Because it wasn't always that way.
Yeah, I think growing up in Southern California and playing tennis here, the level has always been high. So that's kind of what I'm used to. And then when you're playing higher on your team, one, two, three, you're always getting those top players. So I was kind of used to that level and having to compete like that. And I'm sure they were too. But yeah, it was just a part of the game then. I didn't really think about it too much. It was just more so the task at hand every match and how I was going to win.
Who were some of the better players, like the best player you think you ever played against? At any age level?
In general, I would say I played Sloan, I played Madison Keys, and I played Jen Brady, actually, my last college match at NCAAs.
I'm familiar with those names. Yeah, I think most of the listeners are too. Well, that's an extremely high level. And, you know, I mentioned all the success at Baylor. What was the best part of being on a team? Like, tennis being such an individual sport, we saw this at the Laver Cup. I think individual athletes, like tennis players, they kind of still yearn for that missing component of being on a team. So what was the best part of having a squad that you were part of at Baylor?
Yeah, I think there's obviously some positives and negatives to it. But for me, I definitely long to be on a team and have that sort of aspect to it. But it's hard also because it is an individual sport. So at the same time, in a way, during practices and things, you're competing against each other to, you know, who's going to play one or two in the lineup that week. So they're your teammates, but at the same time, there is that sort of aspect going on. But for me, it was just always fun having that support system and that big of a support system beyond the team at Baylor. So that was great.
Did you have specific like preparation, like a couple days out, the day of the match? Were you superstitious? What kind of walk me through your process of getting ready to compete?
I wasn't too superstitious, but I would find myself out on the practice court for way longer than I would need sometimes. And, you know, my coach and sometimes my teammates would be like, okay, Jordan, that's good. It's good. And I'd one more, no matter what it is. But it was just more so being on the court for a little bit too long, gearing up for those harder matches for sure.
Now, as we kind of transitioned into what you're doing now, when did you get attracted to journalism? When did you think, okay, maybe I'm not going to be a pro tennis player, but at least on the educational side, that journalism was something that you could take to and kind of develop your career in?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll go back to 2014 when I ended my college career. I never thought I was going to do anything related to tennis again. And I'm so happy that, you know, my journey has kind of taken me onto this path now. But it started when I got my first job at a printing company. So very random, but I was doing their social media and the CMO at the time noticed that I was a really good writer. And, you know, I graduated with a journalism degree, but I never really thought of it in that way ever. But it wasn't until at that position where I was writing all the landing pages, the blogs, press releases, I was like, I think I kind of want to do this, maybe not in this capacity, but I want to be a storyteller in whatever medium that looks like, in front of the camera, behind it, with a pen, whatever that entails. And so I just feel like everything kind of came together for me, at least when I got the job at Tennis Channel, combining my passion, my love for storytelling with tennis, the sport I love. And I grew up playing since I was 5 years old. So
when did you get on Tennis Channel's radar? I think it was 2019, I want to say, when I first heard that you were brought into the family. Yeah. But when was it that you kind of, someone reached out to you? Did you apply there? How did that process work where you landed at the company?
So back in 2019, I was at Allegiant. So at the airline, working as a technical writer in office. And the reason why I accepted that job in the first place is because I didn't want to just be a good writer, but I also wanted to know how to edit. I think that's very important to have that skill. And I felt like I did everything there, fulfilled that goal of becoming a better editor. And I really wanted to dive into a creative field and explore that storytelling, that journalistic touch to writing. And Tennis Channel came across on my search on, I believe it was LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, that would be perfect. It was for an editor position. Obviously, I have the knowledge of the sport, but I didn't have that editorial background. And Ed and Matt and everyone, they took a chance on me, and I'm so happy they did because now I'm here.
It's crazy how that works out. Like, I love the non-traditional paths, and it takes someone kind of taking a chance on you, but also seeing something that you had the tennis background, obviously had played it and competed at a high level, but also had some skills that it's kind of like clay. You had to be molded a little bit, but they knew there was something there.
Exactly. Yeah.
More with Jordan Sanford here on Tennis Channel Inside In. Will we get to the career stuff and some of the cool stuff you got to work on? I will say you were always kind of a top draft pick in terms of when they needed a stand-in or somebody to actually play tennis on these shoots. I keep going back to this great feature that they did, this great video that they did back in the desert in Indian Wells when you guys were in the retro tennis outfits and trying to pay homage to the 70s legends with the style and the fits there. But had to actually
it was
play,
too so. Funny. Yeah. Honestly, that was the most hilarious experience I've had on a tennis court. So I will say that.
There's some pressure there, though. Like with that one, I remember recently, one of the last things you did was having to kind of hit in front of a green screen. And I got to think it's a little pressure filled. Like you're not actually playing tennis, but you still have to
absolutely.
Do some stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, my last one with Nordstrom, I was behind a green screen as well. And there's probably at least 30 people right in front of me. And they're like, here, hit this tennis ball as hard as you can without hitting any of the cameras, any of the gear or people, of course. And it's like, okay, so I have this little target window and gotta make sure I hit my target spot on and I'm not playing tennis anymore every day. But
yeah, it's takes some skill, obviously. It takes someone with a background there. When you were writing some of these pieces for tennis.com, the baseline section,
yeah,
you had a lot of range in there. There were some serious posts. There were some fun loving, like Feel Good Friday. Let's take a look at all these tennis courts. Did it take you some time to find your voice? Did you want to have a lot of different range and cover different topics? How did you kind of grow as a journalist on the tennis.com website?
I think going into it, I already realized as a tennis player that there was a whole portion of the game that really wasn't being touched on when it comes to small businesses, the fashion, the trends, the off-court news. I felt like that just wasn't a space that wasn't really being looked at the time. And that's something that I really wanted to kind of explore a little bit more. And I'm so thankful for Matt Fitzgerald and Ed McGrogan for letting me kind of take it and just run with it. And that's how I started the whole small business series and featuring different brands and equipment, gear, products that, you know, many people in the tennis world, even recreationally, don't even know about. And I feel like sometimes we get stuck with what's happening in the pro world, the circuit, the Grand Slams, and there's a whole other story being told that wasn't being, you know, paid attention to.
There's a lot of untapped potential out there, and I think we're starting to tap into it, which is great. A lot of that is because of this new era of players. What were some of the favorite pieces that you wrote, or some of the, you know, more impactful ones? The one that comes to mind for me was the Naomi Osaka mental health piece, but if that one, or if there's other ones that you kind of take, you know, more pride than others in.
Yeah, I really like those pieces too. Just kind of, you know, talking about the players off the court and that they're human as well. I think we forget about that sometimes. They're not just tennis players. So I think it's important to have an outlet that kind of shows that a little bit more. But for me, I guess my favorite piece that comes to mind first was my first one, my first small business piece about the courts. Mm-hmm. This place out in Anza Borrego, no one knew about it at the time. And it's just a desert oasis. If you're a tennis enthusiast, you need to go there. It's definitely a special place that kind of combines that social aspect with tennis, you know, and that's where I think we really, really need and more of.
Yeah, it's more accessible than the other pieces you highlighted, like the Goldstein tennis court. I think you may not be able to get a time on there.
Yeah. This one is for everyone, no matter where you are in the world. Good. It's worth a trip down there.
That's good. You've also got to conduct interviews when you were here, which you're still doing in your other gigs and your other jobs. I remember one of the last things was Rafa at the TC set in Indian Wells. And I mean, meeting him has to be, you know, a different type of experience. But
what
was that like? And what was it like kind of getting to interview some of these players you looked up to and maybe played against when you were in college?
I mean, it was just a dream for me. It was a dream kind of coming full circle. And to, you know, kind of have that relatability to these players and create, you know, more so of that welcoming environment, talking to another tennis player, I felt kind of put them at ease a little bit and was able to kind of dig a little deeper into some of those personal topics and things that you saw on baseline. But for me, going back to Indian Wells, this last one with Rafa, I was actually not there as an interviewer. I was a photographer during the shoot. So it was one of my few times that I actually got to step into a different role outside of editorial. And I had so, so much fun. Everyone was coming through the tent that day. And I'll never forget Rafa, though. So sweet. So down to earth.
Yeah. And you mentioned kind of being inspired by Venus and, you know, obviously Serena, Roger. Like, we're at a point now where we're losing a lot of these legends and people we looked up to. So I know there's a lot of exciting players coming up and there's some new trends to develop, but it's a little bit of a tough time for tennis with some of our idols and our role models stepping away from the game.
Oh yeah, it is. I mean, the reason why Federer, Serena, Venus, all these players are who they are is because of, you know, how they interacted off the court and their personalities off the court as well. And I think tennis is in good hands with everyone that's coming up, Tiafoe, Kyrgios, Casper Ruud, all these different players coming up on the court. It's great. But I think where we're going to need some improvement is just the character, you know, more personality, more energy. I think that's what really carries the game and makes someone, you know, kind of stand out among the rest.
Yeah, they held the mantle for so long. We almost took it for granted, the consistency there and just being great ambassadors of the sport too, which is something that takes time and that you have to, as a human, kind of grow into.
100%.
Are you surprised how, I mean, maybe like trendy is a bad word, but in terms of like showing their style, showing their flair, and also not being afraid to speak up on serious issues, are you surprised or, I guess, more impressed that this next generation is more outspoken?
I'm definitely not. I'm not shocked at all. I actually wish it would happen a little bit more. I think that's honestly why, you know, Kyrgios and these players are so appealing to me, because you're getting, you know, a whole new generation that looks up to these players for their energy, for who they are and for their mannerisms and things, and they want to kind of embody it. And again, I feel like that just, it brings a different kind of feel to the game that I think is just, it's missing a little bit more. So I'm good with more talking and more, you know, just expressing themselves beyond the court. I think that's what the sport needs.
Yeah, it's always been like a hot button issue. Like, tennis is a great game, but it maybe needs more personality, needs more style, the off court stuff, getting into things like fashion and the arts. And where I land on it, Jordan, is there's so many tennis players. Not everyone, like, there are reclusive people that I understand that's their MO and they don't want to be that outgoing, but it's nice to have a mix of people that are outgoing and are going to kind of take you behind the curtain.
Absolutely. I mean, even Naomi with her fashion brands, I mean, she's everywhere right now. I think she also has the beauty and the makeup as well. So I love seeing stuff like that. Also Kyrgios, even something simple as wearing a Celtics jersey on the court, you know, now you're bringing like the basketball, you know, people, fans into the game as well. And you're introducing more people that just didn't even care to pay attention to the sport. Now they're all of a sudden at the US Open watching.
A couple more things here with Jordan Sanford on Tennis Channel Inside In. I just want to talk about kind of what you're going on and what you're doing right now. There's a lot of stuff, but I wanted to talk about the movie, the All-American Homecoming show, I should say, on the CW network, where you're working as a technical director. A show about a girl, Cliff Notes version, obviously, Los Angeles girl goes to a historically black college to chase her dream of playing tennis. So as a technical director, are you kind of the expert on the set? Like, this is how tennis actually works?
I am.
It's an important job.
Very important, very important. I actually started off as one of the characters, the team captain, as her body double for the first season. Mm. So I was doing that. And then they were like, you know, we would love to have you become the technical director because she actually gets injured in the second season, which might be a slight giveaway.
Okay.
Happens early on though.
Spoiler.
So, yeah, spoiler alert.
I'm very critical though of sports scenes in movies not being realistic. That's why there's some truth into why I say it is a serious job, because I think some movies and some shows, even some that I enjoy, they don't get it right. And I do think tennis, and maybe that's a question for you, why do you think tennis is so hard to get right in movies and TV shows? Because it seems like a lot of times it's just not accurate at all.
I agree with you. I mean, if you look at the game, it's so technical. Mm-hmm. From the footwork to getting into position, now you got to worry about a swing, mm-hmm. and how that looks like, court positioning. There's so many minor details that add up, and you know, you can really tell if those actors know how to play, yeah. or when, you know, a body double even is being used. So it's a very technical game that's hard to get correct. Yeah, fully, which I understand.
It's so fast also, it's hard to shoot without cutting a lot. And, you know, I think it's great that you're doing that. The variety work, I've read some of your pieces there. Still with the sports, you know, still in love with sports and you know, writing some stuff about college athletes and kind of just educating them in terms of what to do when you do make that transition to pro money-wise. What type of pieces on variety are you looking to release here and still kind of focus on?
Well, I'm actually going to be going over, I've been working a lot with the Variety Content Studio, which is a client-based studio rather than the Variety House. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually making that kind of switch onto Variety House a little bit more. So you'll see probably more of that entertainment, more mm-hmm. financial entertainment news coming from me. That's in the awesome. Coming months. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, with your, you know, background in tennis and journalism, but also interviewing, photography as well, as you mentioned, message, I guess, do you have a message for like these young kids, maybe tennis players that are looking to get into the media industry, or just students out there that are looking to break in? What would that message be, or some advice now that you've got some credibility? Yeah.
I think as a former athlete, just to not be too hard on yourself, never be too hard on yourself, and know that everyone is on their own journey and their own path. And that looks different. Just as long as you're kind of going in that direction and you know where you want to land, I think that's so important, but just know that it takes time and it doesn't happen overnight. Even for me, I had to take the steps to get to Tennis Channel, to get to where I am now. It didn't just happen after NCAAs and all of a sudden, you know, here I am writing about the sport. But it takes time, and don't be hard on yourself. Don't be too mm-hmm. critical.
It's definitely a marathon. It's not a sprint, and you want to make sure you enjoy those small victories. And my other thing would just be like you've done, get your reps in, you know, get your chances and get your time in. And
exactly. Yeah. For me, I mean, even going back to, it started, of course, with tennis, having that background. And then I had to kind of learn how to write and how to edit what really well and take those steps in order to get to Tennis Channel, where I was finally able to dive into that editorial. And sometimes, I mean, again, it just doesn't happen with a press of the button, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But as long as you embrace that journey and embrace the hardships and the challenges that come along the way.
Certainly some sage advice there. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask, you're also working with the USTA. What's that like, and what kind of stuff are you specifically focusing on working with the standard bearer for tennis in this country?
Yeah, it's been really amazing so far. It's just been probably about a few months now with the USTA Foundation. So I'm more so geared towards the charity work, the NJTLs as well, and helping underprivileged children, under-resourced kids kind of have access to the game, but not only that, but education as well.
That's
and
awesome.
Telling that side of the story.
It's awesome. Yeah. And there's a direct link to some of the stuff we've seen with some of these American tennis players, men and women, that have made it, that have had successful runs and are having successful careers that the USTA.
Tiafo is one of them. So
probably doesn't happen without, you know, some resources and some people like yourself putting in time at the USTA. Well, Jordan Sanford, this has been great. Last thing, I guess, do you have anything kind of to look out for that we should be looking out for, pieces, some work that you're doing?
I think I already previously mentioned this, but I do have some more variety stories coming soon in the coming months. So be on the lookout for that, as well as All American. The season two actually premieres on October 10th, I believe. So please tune in for that and let me know your thoughts. Hopefully the tennis looks great this season.
That's what I'm going to be watching. I'll be slow mowing the tennis scenes, but please. that'll be the focus.
Please do. Yeah. Feel free to judge me.
Absolutely. I always am. Jordan, this has been great. Thanks again for coming on. And you always put up with me kind of over when we were working together. So
of course.
Had to have you on, but Jordan Sanford, thanks for joining Tennis Channel Insight In.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Tennis Channel Inside In. Thanks to Jan Michael Gamble. Thanks to Jordan Sanford. And thanks to everybody out there for listening as we continue on. We're in the post-major season, but still weekly episodes on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, which can be found at tennis.com/podcast. We have a ton of great shows, ton of content. We have a lot to listen to, a lot to whet your appetite. And we're going to keep it going on the website. We're on all your podcast platforms, from Spotify to Apple Podcasts to Google Podcasts, where everywhere that podcast can be found. Another show next week, we're going to be talking to John Lloyd, the former British tennis player, Grand Slam finalist. That's a preview episode for next week. He's going to come to the Santa Monica studios. He has a new book out. You're not going to want to miss that as well. For Jan Michael Gamble and Jordan Sanford, my name is Mitch Michaels. This has been Tennis Channel Inside In. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.